I think one of the things that Apple has done remarkably well is, even though they are a hardware company, they have been incredibly thoughtful about only getting into hardware spaces where the hardware is not a commodity and where owning the hardware has some long-term benefit.
Welcome back to Unsolicited Feedback. This is now part two of our conversation with Behzad Surjani, with me, your co-host Fareed Mosavat, and co-host Ravi Mehta. In this part of our episode, we go deep on the questions and concerns and issues and future of the electronic vehicle market, talk about Tesla and other companies, and what might need to change in order for that market to grow. I hope you enjoy it. I'll let us dive right in.
Yeah, so there's been some really interesting developments recently in the EV market. Apple recently announced that they are killing their car project. Tesla just missed earnings. Rivian stock has been down. There's a lot of EV inventory sitting on dealer lots. And what seemed like an inevitable trend towards an EV transition feels like it's hit a speed bump. There are tons of EVs on the road. I see them all over in LA. But when I talk to people recently who are thinking about getting their first EV, there's a lot of reservations around, is the technology really ready? You know, will I be able to get to where I want to go? There's range anxiety. There's anxiety about figuring out whether or not they have the room in their garage to just set up an EV charging station and how much everything is going to cost. And so I think an interesting question to dig into is, why have we hit the speed bump in the EV market today? And one of the frameworks that occurred to me as I was thinking through this is, Onkali Kaba has this framework called the adjacent user theory, where he talks about the fact that products generally find product market fit with a core user. That core user is someone for whom the product works really, really well, and they grow to a point where they've exhausted that base of core users. And then you move on to an adjacent user, sort of the next user in terms of the concentric circles of people that your product could really help. And when you move into serving that adjacent user, the user needs change. And oftentimes, product market fit that felt really tight can loosen. And it could be that right now within the EV market, we're actually at that point where there is an adjacent user that we're now moving into, people that were reluctant to be first adopters of EVs and have different needs than the people that adopted EVs. The early adopters of EVs were very environmentally conscious. To some extent, they were trend conscious. They were generally higher earning because the cars are expensive, generally lived in urban or suburban areas where they had shorter commutes. And now as we think about EVs growing to the rest of the US market, people have pretty different needs when they're living in different areas. They may need hauling capacity. They may not have EV charging networks near them. They may not have the ability to afford EVs at the current price points that they're at. So I think interesting question for us to tee up and dig into and understand is, why is the EV market hitting a hiccup right now when, you know, all of the thinking, I think, up until this year was that EVs were just going to continue to increase and increase in terms of adoption?
Yeah. I think one of the interesting things here for me is and this might be because me sitting in Berkeley, California, it's a totally different world than the normal world. A common friend of all of ours, Kevin Weiss, once told me, fact check this, but once told me that there are 10 times as many F-150s sold in America than Priuses. And so if you see more Priuses than F-150s, you live in a bubble. And so I was driving around with my kids. This was like 2 years ago. And I played the game. I said, let's count Priuses and let's count F-150s. I think we got to like 26 Priuses before we saw a single F-150. And just to be clear, it was a weekend. So a lot of the work trucks weren't out, you know, like for weekday construction, that kind of thing. But again, that means my neighbors are a 2,500-to-1 outlier like world. So let's just be real about like where I live and my perspective on this. But I thought they kind of had crossed the chasm. The Model 3 and Y have both been some of the best-selling cars in America for the last year. They started out being the best-selling luxury car, but I think now they're near the top of the list of best-selling cars. And I thought we'd already crossed the chasm. But the question I think you're asking is that actually not true? Is it that the early adopter product market fit group was bigger than we thought, urban elite, environmentally conscious, mostly drives 30 to 50 miles a day, two cars, that kind of thing, is actually bigger than we thought. And it accelerated through that. And now there's this other wall, truly not even adjacent, market shift that has to happen for EVs to be more adopted. And I don't really know the answer, but I suspect that there's something to that. I think it's almost like they grew so fast and Tesla kind of sucked the air out of the market for all the other automakers in EVs because their product is better on a bunch of dimensions we can talk about, and grew so fast by doing the make more, make them cheaper, make them easier to get, make them fat, make it more accessible, make it quicker, make it have higher range, that it maybe muscled other people out. But also, I don't know. I'm curious if you have other thoughts on it, because like, it's hard for me to see. I will just say the Model Y is, we have one, just to be clear, is like the most generic car you can own in the Bay Area. It went from like interesting to like totally pedestrian over the course of 2.5 years.
Yeah, I also own a Model Y.
So boring.
So, I mean, I think that there's so much to talk about here, but one of the things that I was just thinking about with the Prius to F-150 comparison is the underlying behaviors and needs of the people who are driving those vehicles. Like, I imagine that if you just looked at someone who buys a truck and whether or not that car is used for work outside of just getting to work, you see a different behavior pattern than someone who owns a Prius, because I've kind of hauled things when I had a Prius, but like, you're really limited there. That car is not putting out real power. And so I wonder if part of what we're pointing at is, like, even in just that example before we get to EVs, is different needs from a vehicle themselves, and like different wear patterns, different frequency of use. As you were describing some of the different things for the EV, I'm like, how many people who drive an F-150 have the opportunity to plan and then go sit at a charging station if they don't have one in their home for an hour a day, right? Versus, you know, normal context of use. But yeah, it is. I mean, we're all three of us are sitting on the West Coast, where not only is there radical adoption of these vehicles, there's also reasonably good infrastructure. Like, and in Seattle, there are EV charging stations, not just for Tesla, but for a lot of the other opportunities at grocery stores. So as a part of the regular rhythm of your life, you have access to some of the complementary things that come with needing an EV. Which I think contributes to what are some of the other factors tied up in buying that decision? Like, how often are people who drive Priuses really buying cars anyway, right? I drove mine for 150,000 miles and then was like, okay, I probably could have eked more out of it too. Like, I'm not
the
buying cars.
The market you are selling Priuses and maybe EVs too is not the market of people who buy a new car every 2 years. That's for sure. So that's interesting. No. Let's think about this. So like, one, and cars are not a single use case, single job to be done product, right? They solve for multiple ones. This is, by the way, quick aside, I like the idea, that little MVP, no, don't do this thing of like, make a skateboard, make a scooter, make a bike, make a car. But like, give me a break. A skateboard and a car have totally different markets and totally different use cases. A skateboard is not a minimum viable product for a car. That's ridiculous. It's absurd. We need to stop using that diagram. I get it conceptually. Make a small thing that works. That is correct, but it's a poor example. I hate it because even cars,
you're not carrying your kids on your skateboard.
An MVP. You don't go to the grocery store on a skateboard. It's ridiculous. Bike to e-bike, yes, I get it. Like, that's cool, but come on, totally absurd. Anyway, sorry, but like, cars are a multi-use case thing, and they are not the same for everyone. So the car and how it sits for a person who lives in a relatively semi-urban area or suburban area where most of their driving is to places within 8 to 10 miles of their home, they have a driveway and they have kids that they're moving around and they're mostly traveling locally, is totally different than a person who lives in like Montana, where a trip to the grocery store is 50 to 60 miles, right? That is like a totally different thing. Hauling, working, you have an RV, you have a bus. Even just going to Tahoe is a totally different use case. Sorry, bougie West Coast elite use case. But like, going on a road trip to a place where you're going that also has infrastructure is very different than you know, road trips, long commutes, long distance, et cetera. So I think that's one piece. And they're pretty saturated in the places where it's a really good fit. And the second is this reliance on a network of chargers. Like EVs work great if you're home every day because you never have to think about charging. You just plug it in and you're done. You need a driveway. So it doesn't work for anybody who lives in a rental. Doesn't work for anybody who lives in a place where they don't own the infrastructure. But if you're a homeowner with a driveway in a, you know, in your home every day, it's better than gas. But if you go anywhere, it's worse. Yeah. So like, how do you solve that? And then there's this network problem. And I'll just say non-Tesla networks are terrible, like basically useless.
I don't necessarily want to draw a super strong comparison here, but the buying pattern feels more like B2B software than B2C. You often have multiple constituents. You have to think about switching costs. You have to think about interoperability with other tools in your tool stack. Am I driving on paved roads? If I'm not driving on paved roads, I probably need a lifted vehicle. Can I reasonably get access to charging? If not, I probably need a hybrid or a gas car. Can I afford this? Does this make sense for all of my contexts of use? Is my partner comfortable with this? Does this fit our kids, bikes, whatever? There are just so many more factors, I feel like, they get pulled into these infrequent, high significance decisions, like buying a home, buying a car. They don't feel like consumer purchases.
I think if we zoom out to like the most fundamental reasons people buy a car, they buy a car for two reasons. One is utility, and two is personal expression. And so a car is often a pretty important part of a person's identity. And then you need a car to haul the things around that you need to haul around. It could just be yourself. It could be your family. It could be other things that you need to move around. And so far, what's interesting is the EV market has not really addressed either the personal expression needs or the utility needs of the F-150 buyer. And the F-150 is still the number one car in the US, even after there's been all of this transition to electric vehicles. And none of Tesla's cars really meet that. I don't think the Cybertruck is going to meet that. It's just too weird looking to be the thing that replaces the F-150. The Rivian is just too expensive and not as utilitarian, especially, you know, with range anxiety. And so I think this is a really good example of where product market fit comes down to very specific use case driven consumer psychology things that, you know, on paper don't seem like they're that important. It kind of dovetails with some of the things that we're talking about with Qual. You know, there are underlying reasons why a person does or doesn't buy a product that are really hard to tell in the data and are really easy to gloss over when you're thinking about product planning. And so far, I think the EV industry has done that. They sort of ignored the obvious, which is that there is this very large segment of buyers that need to come into the EV fold, but no product so far has done a good job of meeting their needs. And I think that that has led to this hookup. And it's going to require a product, I think, that feels 10x better. Like the Tesla felt 10x better than the alternatives, than the Prius, than other cars in terms of, you know, styling and features and range and the network. Today, there's not that 10x better alternative. And why would a person who has, you know, a pickup truck that's working really well for them transition over to an EV if they're not confident that they're going to get the same utility from it?
I am a believer that Tesla's as an EV, because software is so much more important, because a lot of the features and the network, the charging network, are such important factors in the buying decision, is a 10x better product, not only than other EVs by like maybe a long shot. Like, I've made the decision that I will not buy a non-Tesla EV until there's interoperability on the supercharger network. Like, it's a non-starter. I won't do it. But their cars only really serve a certain kind of customer, right? Which we've already described, so I won't get into it. There's a reason cars are a many, 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 many SKU business, even for like niche builders, right? Even BMW has like 15 SKUs, right? And they're solidly in the luxury performance market, right? I will say a Tesla does not serve a luxury buyer that well. It is not that luxurious a vehicle, right? It does not serve the adventure Subaru market, right? Doesn't have enough clearance. It's not high enough performance off-road, et cetera, et cetera. It is a good enough, but not great middle of the road car. And even look at Toyota. Toyota makes like 30 cars that are all basically the same at different price points, different levels of luxury, and different little pieces of differentiation in order to have a fit for each person, because it is such a high considered purchase problem. It is like an unbundling, right? And Tesla's business model requires them to be a low SKU product with also minimal year-to-year changes, because they have to generate them at scale. And the way they're winning against everybody else in EVs is by being so good at manufacturing and price that they can drive their prices down over time. That means like minimizing the number of things. And also, just to be clear, they're full stack. They don't have suppliers. They actually don't have the room for variation. The things that have made them a winner in the market actually are in the way of them building 50 SKUs. And then we can talk about Cybertruck. I don't know what the market for that thing is, but it's certainly not a massive product market fit expansion, right? There's not a bunch of non-Tesla fans who are suddenly buying Cybertrucks, right?
As you're saying this, I'm almost wondering, is it a tell that you are approaching adjacent users, or maybe to your point, free, like crossing the chasm, that so many of the next set of audiences have the same concerns that early users had, but they're willing to like interrogate the switching costs differently? So like, I had range anxiety. I had concerns about charging. Is there going to be enough spots for me? Is the network dense enough? Like, you know, will this work? Is the battery going to perform in the cold? I hear all of those concerns from people who have not yet purchased, and I would argue are sort of adjacent users, because they have enough of a point of friction in their lives, some part of the consideration journey where they're like, nah, I don't think this is there. And I'm almost wondering if for listeners, we can abstract out, how do you detect that this is an adjacent user versus just like someone who's not going to be probably your target audience for cycles or iterations of this evolution?
That's a great question, because yeah, it's like the same objections, they just matter more. So how do you tell the difference? So I think one is just the simple acceleration of like new user acquisition, right? What makes an early adopter market very, very attractive? One is high word of mouth. Early adopters care about things, tend to also be amplifiers. Why? The reason they are early adopters is the social value it brings to them as a person who likes cool things, right? So if I am one of the first people to buy a Tesla Y, guess what the complaint people have about Tesla owners? How do you know someone owns a Tesla? Don't worry, they'll tell you. So you have high word of mouth, which should lead to high, not virality, but accelerating acquisition, right?
Yeah.
Second is super high NPS. This is the thing about early adopters. They look past all the problems. This is why people look like Elon fanboys or whatever. They're super high NPS. They're 11 out of 10s. They love their products. They give tons of feedback, right? And they look past those objections. They see them as things that will be solved in the future. So I think like we saw this with Slack, honestly, or any product. There's a point at which one, your organic acquisition starts to flatline. That is a clear sign, I think, of like you're starting to hit these saturation things. It's not that your new user acquisition is declining, but it used to be that it was growing because people were talking to other people who were talking to other people. And now it's like your new user acquisition is not scaling with the size of your audience, if that makes sense. So if I have a million DAUs and I have 10,000 people signing up, if I have 2 million DAUs, I should have at least 20,000. And that ratio starts to shrink, I think, is a clear sign that the word of mouth thing isn't really happening anymore, which means you're getting to people who are not amplifiers. The second is the one you're talking about, which is objections going from small to actual blockers. So I'm thinking about at Slack, there were objections people had early, not having certain security compliance, not being able to control who's in what channel, it's open-ended, not having administration controls, that went from these are annoying, but I'll still buy, to I literally will not purchase this if you don't do this. So that's maybe the other signal. Those are the two best that I can come up with.
Maybe if I can reframe the second thing you were saying, just as I'm processing it, it's things that went from speed bumps to roadblocks.
Oh, that's good.
Like things that were points of friction that, you know, early adopters, power, like, yeah, it's fine. being like, I cannot pass this point at any moment. And I think that's actually probably in partnership with your point about the shift in just rate of growth. Those end up being really good signals that like maybe you have hit saturation in a certain market and have to think about a different motion. Because to your point at Slack, it was like, go get certain certifications, change how we thought about customer success and what the onboarding process looked like for scaled accounts, higher touch engagements, more curation. Like we had to knock down right. those roadblocks so that we could continue.
Yeah. So as just to use an analogy to the EV thing for really, Tesla Model X is a $100,000 vehicle, roughly. The low luxuriousness of the interior goes from speed bump. Yeah, but it's so cool in a bunch of other ways to why would I spend $100,000 for something that doesn't even have X,
plastic,
you know, or whatever. Doesn't let me customize the interior or whatever it is. Yeah. I don't know. I'm not a person who cares about the vagaries of a $100,000 car, so it's hard for me to give examples, but yeah, things like that. Or range, right?
I think there's an interesting question of what is the cost of making a mistake? So for an early adopter, the cost of making a mistake, both perceived and actual, is lower. Because I'm an early adopter. I want to try out new technologies.
Oh, that's interesting.
I've done this in the past. Some of them have worked. And when they have worked, I've really benefited and enjoyed being on the leading edge. And when they haven't worked, not a big deal. I'm a risk taker. And so I'm willing to sell that or discontinue using it. Versus for someone who's now, you know, on the other side of the chasm for the EV market, I think we've got a set of people for whom making the mistake is much more costly. Part of it is price. They have a limited amount to spend on a car that may or may not, where the Tesla may be on the edge of that. So they have less ability to kind of trade in and out of that vehicle. The impact of range anxiety might be higher. Like if we need to stop and wait for 30 minutes to charge because we ran out of range, that's okay in certain circumstances. But if you're late to work or you can't make a delivery or something like that, the cost of that is much higher. And so I think this is an interesting point. The same drawbacks resonate with both the early adopters as well as the late adopters, but the cost associated with making the wrong decision has gotten much higher for those folks. Hence, the lack of willingness to make that purchase decision and to take that risk.
I think that point about risk is an important one. It's like, how many people who bought a Vision Pro were like, if I don't use it, who cares? Maybe I'll return it. Maybe I won't. I got to tweet a picture of myself, you know, wearing it. Is that is like a piece of the puzzle. Some of that is having access to the money to do it. But also it's that I am gaining social value by my participation in this thing. And so practical value is not the only consideration, right? And so this is actually a really interesting framework is as you shift from social value, I am cool because I do X, to practical value, price is not the only consideration. It's also, do you meet the niche needs that I have as a buyer? And so this is why you see so much like chopping up in especially car markets is because it's a massive market. It's a huge amount of dollars and owning 1 or 2% of it is highly valuable. So it's worth building a product that's a perfect fit. You know, there's a specific Subaru that's pushed up a couple extra inches and is way more expensive, et cetera. And there's a market for that car, right? It is economically valuable to build it. And the reason it is because there's so many people who buy cars and there's somebody for whom it's a perfect fit.
I wonder if Tesla's very limited focus on just a handful of SKUs that meet very clear needs has actually meant that they hit the end of the social value faster. Because now there's so many Teslas on the road. They don't change from year to year. There's no value in getting the 2024 Model Y versus the 2023 Model Y, or not like a value that other people can see. So that phase of when, you know, it said something about me to drive a Tesla around has come to an end now that they're much more mass market available vehicles. And I think the pace at which they're releasing new things is not fast enough to continue with that versus the rest of the car industry has been built around every new year. We want to release something new. We're going to have special editions. We're going to have lots of different special edition colors. We're going to keep that flywheel going so that there's always some social value.
Durable goods are a bad business, right? High cost durable goods, because people buy them and then they hang on to them for like a decade. And the way cars have solved this generally, is by making the new one new and shiny and making it worth your while to replace it every 2 to 3 years. I bet the customers you really want are the ones replacing their vehicles every 2 to 3 years, right? Like, what a perfect person, especially in a luxury market, 15 to 60K leasers, et cetera. I think if you look, Tesla rhymes with Apple, right? Low number of SKUs, targeted towards very simplistic. It does a few things super, super well. But one thing Apple, last maybe year or two aside on the iPhone, has done very well is I have this joke that like every time I see the new laptop, I think mine looks like a piece of garbage. I was like, I used to think this was the coolest device in the whole world. And now this new one came out and the one I have looks like crap. And this, it was true for iPhones for a very long time that even though the utility didn't increase that much, the social value of it and also the build quality, the quality of experience got enough better that you were like, why would I ever keep a phone for 2 years? This new one is so much better. And cars do a decent job of doing this through styling and technology and a few other things. But yeah, I've sat in a brand new Y. It's got a little bit of nice styling, but it in no way feels all that different. And so that's a really interesting point is not only is it saturated, now I don't feel cool because all my neighbors have one. There's also no reason to get the new one because it's about the same as the old one. And it's cheaper, which is cool. But the resale value of mine went down. So it's not like there's a whole bunch of things like that. It's like just worth keeping on to. So what is the recommendation here? I think is one, not that I'm in the business of telling Elon what to do. The guy's a much better business person than I ever will be. But I do think have there be an upgrade reason is a big deal even for a single model. And it is not that I'm going to go from Y to Cybertruck or from Y to X. I need a reason to buy a new Y. Now, that's like not good for the environment. And it's kind of a weird thing to say out loud. But if you want to sell more cars, you need retention with your existing users, right? Like repeat purchase, I think is one. And give reasons for that. And I think these things are so close to the edge on the performance that it's not performance that's going to drive it. If my car went any faster, my kids would throw up. You know, it's like not worth it. I think that's one. Any other pieces of advice?
You got at where I was curious to take the conversation, which is what gets people to purchase again and why I think Apple probably exited the car business, which was the motion that works for iPhones and for laptops does not work for a durable good. And if we are a business with a certain kind of consumption pattern and a certain margin profile, maybe building durable goods is not the thing that we can justify. No. Because I agree with you. My car gets over-the-air software updates on a regular basis. I've taken it into Tesla. I've owned the car for a year and a half, almost two and a half years. I've taken it into Tesla twice. One was a window like a windshield replacement because of a rock. And the other one was because of a tire
issue.
Same
story.
I used to take my car in every how many thousand miles, right? Like, I don't even think about talking to Tesla because it's like, oh, here's a software update. Your cameras work better. Our autopilot is better. I'm like, great. And I hopefully will not have to do anything for 10 years because most of what I bought was a brain wrapped in a chassis. And I think that's, to Robbie's point, when you think about utility, that's what I paid for. And most of the price of the car was the brain and the continual software updates and those things. And like, I drove a Prius before. I'm not trying to win any style points with the car that I drive. But I think for me, there's not a wildly compelling reason unless they were to change the underlying utility, which is like, give me better clearance, maybe give me control over suspension or something like that. So that because I go snowboarding a lot, like I want to do different things with the car. But I don't know that, to your point, like that takes them from a 4 SKU to a 8 SKU company. And can they justify that?
Yeah. Second, I would say is expansion of SKUs and customization to help people meet their needs better. That one's a tough one and really outside of the value, but that would be the traditionalist car business. It's like, be more enterprisey, allow more knobs to be turned and more customization to happen, right?
But if you take the Apple approach, right, this is let Tesla have an app store, which is my car is wrapped because I take it to the mountains and I was like, Tesla paint is not great. I will cover it in something. And there's an entire aftermarket industry for Teslas. And it's like, great, Tesla actually doesn't need to worry about that. They're not capturing that value, but like the end customer can customize and tweak and whatever. And the cost of Tesla offering that is probably high and the benefit is low.
I think one of the things that Apple has done remarkably well is even though they are a hardware company, they have been incredibly thoughtful about only getting into hardware spaces where the hardware is not a commodity and where owning the hardware has some long-term benefit. And so for many years, there was conjecture that Apple was going to release a TV, that they were going to have some HDTV. And for a little while, HDTVs were novel and potentially Apple could release hardware that was better than what was out there. But I think they saw the writing on the wall, which is ultimately TV hardware is going to get commoditized. And the way that we own this market is we own the software layer. And so we have the Apple TV, we have the Apple streaming service. I think they've also done this in the fitness area. For a long time, people were saying, oh, Apple, you know, might acquire Peloton or other fitness assets to have other hardware in a person's home. But I think they also understood this fitness hardware is a commodity. And instead, through the Apple Watch and through the Apple Fitness applications, we can own the software side of things. And I think that this is the same conclusion that they came to with the Apple Car. They own CarPlay. They own the software in a lot of vehicles. There's not a lot of incremental benefit for them to own the hardware, especially as EV hardware becomes more commoditized. And they don't own the software in the Tesla case, but in many other cases, in many EVs, people are primarily interfacing through their EV through CarPlay. And so they've got a great position in that market, despite not having made the investment in hardware and with limited upside to making a pretty significant long-term investment in a durable piece of hardware. And that's a contrast to Vision Pro, where that hardware is definitely not a commodity. Yeah. There's capabilities that only Apple can build within that. And so it makes sense for them to make that hardware investment in that area.
The Apple Car thing has been a rumor for so long. It's so hard to know what is real, what is not real. Does this project even exist? Did it ever exist? Who knows? Let's assume it did. But I think self-driving is the opportunity that creates differentiable hardware in the car space for a company like Apple. Their world is like, what was Tesla good at? Building EV drivetrains and batteries. That's not what Apple does, right? They make chips, they make sensors, they make output devices, et cetera. They're really good at those kinds of hardware. And those things are important in a self-driving vehicle. Do you have great sensors? Do you have a great interaction experience? A friend of mine's favorite interview questions is to design an interface for a self-driving car. It is a complicated problem, right? It is not a steering wheel. It's not pedals. It is like, what is it? Is it like an Uber interface? Does it even have an interface? There are all those kinds of great questions. I wonder how much of this is just they took a look at it and decided that, especially at consumer level cost, because remember, there's like a couple $100,000 of computers in a Waymo. Like, this was way further away than was worth building. Apple is an innovator, but they're a last mover innovator. And a world where this is two decades out just doesn't seem like a fit for them.
How much do you think this is really push versus pull? Like, how much do you think this move is them deciding that Apple Car is not the opportunity they want to pursue versus them deciding that they got to invest all R&D into AI right now, and any time wasted on anything else is just moronic?
Robbie's talked about risk a couple times, and we were talking about like risk to business, and you just mentioned brand risk, and we've talked about adjacent users for a good chunk of this. How do you think about balancing the risk of going after these opportunities when you've clearly, like, you've hit saturation in a certain market, you have something that works, there are other things out there? How do you conceptualize that?
Apple is an exception because they're the world's most profitable, most interesting company in the world with infinite things. I think once I did the math, that Apple could be the sole LP in like every venture capital fund in the world and still have cash left over. It's bananas what they could do. There's no like limited resource. There's limited focus, but not limited dollars, right? You know, the further you go towards diversification, meaning I do thing X and thing Y is totally different with no synergy, the harder it is to do well. The best moves are relatively adjacent, right? Like, the closer you are to the core. What is my core? How do I leverage the assets I have in that core? And how do I use that to expand into an adjacent or related or similar market? I think is generally the right approach. Even things like AWS are in some ways leveraging of existing assets. They were their own first best customer, right? And they were able to do it. It looks like I was an e-commerce company and now I'm a cloud company. And that is true. It's a totally different business and separate. But there were reasons Amazon was equipped to do that, that a billion-dollar funded brand new startup was not. Does that make sense? And so that's the question I would ask of any new product. Like, that's the beauty of the AirPods. Such a wonderful little business. Shitty business if you're just building headphones. Great business because you own the iPhone and it's so deeply integrated that it's an awesome company, an awesome product, an awesome business. So to me, that's my mental model framework for analyzing these things. And that's, again, why the car felt so out of band. You know, it just doesn't look or feel or act like any of the other things, except that people said it was cool, so they should do it. You know, it's like,
well, yeah, to your point, it doesn't come from the core, which is a good principle. Ravi, I'm curious your take.
I would just echo that. I think it really comes down to both the reward and the risk for Apple is at a very like high tier relative to every other company. And so what a meaningful success for them looks like is so much higher than what any other company would define as meaningful success. And the risk profile as a result is also much higher. And for Apple, I think there's a brand risk in you release an Apple car, the first time that kills a pedestrian, like that's a major news story, whether it's self-driving or not. And so there's all of this brand system risk for something that I agree with Reid. I'm not sure that it really clearly reinforces the core. I think for Apple, they have had a pretty consistent strategy of saying, can we own 90% of a premium market in this space? And if they can, they go in and they do it. They own 90% of the premium phone market, of the premium headphone market. And I can't ever see that being the case with cars, right? They were never going to be someone that had that level of market share in cars, especially internationally. Like as Apple has become a more and more international company, they weren't necessarily going to be able to produce a vehicle that could work well in markets with much lower price points and where cars serve a very different purpose than they do in the US, where they're much more budget-oriented and more utilitarian.
Yeah, I think that's it's such an important lesson and also a hard thing to understand from the outside at times. I remember I was very early in my career at Facebook when we killed off some of the social viewing stuff that we had done around video, and we had millions of active users. And we're just like, this doesn't benefit the core thing that we are trying to do in a sufficient way that like this team should continue to work on this. And 2-3 years into my career, I'm like, we're killing off a multi-million user product. From that perspective, you think this is wild. And then from the, does this reinforce and come from the core? No, this is a thing, but there are these other opportunities with different risk and reward profiles. And I think it's often hard as a product person because you see the reward, you may not see the risk, and you don't always ask, like, how well does this continue to sustain that growth, right? Because a lot of growth is what is sustainable, not just what else can we go and capture.
One of, I think, Mark's very underappreciated superpowers is that he has zero sentimentality about past products.
1,000%.
Very much willing to kill things to move on to the future. And you could see that in the evolution of the products. Facebook, every single 2 to 3 years looks fundamentally different than it did 2 to 3 years before. And that's allowed the company to make the really hard decisions that I think a lot of other companies can't make. And as a result, they get weighed down by those decisions.
Yeah. Ami Vora, who was running part of ads at the time that I was there, had this great saying that it's only prioritization if it hurts. And that was like a really framework for us of like, are we really making the hard trade-off or are we just doing a thing that like looks more comfortable?
And that's a wrap on this week's episode of Unsolicited Feedback with our guest, Behzad Surjani. Thanks for listening.